And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
My wife and I are taking a few days, a little quiet time, spend a little time on the beach walking in Gearhart, Oregon. And in the evening, we don't have cable here. We can get movies, but we often just sit and read a good book. It is interesting because her idea of a good book and mine are so very different. Last night, she was sitting and reading a detective story, fiction. I, on the other hand, had my favorite book, a book updated every year that I wait for impatiently, and I finally got it. And I brought it with me down here so I could just enjoy each page. Over 100 pages of numbers. Some pages have hundreds of numbers that one can look at to try to understand better somehow the process of investing. And this is a book. It's called The Matrix, and it comes out from Dimensional Funds for Dimensional Advisors. And I am fortunate enough to be able to get a copy each year because I write a lot about DFA funds. Now, out of this 100 pages, there is one page that I think is just loaded with important information about investing. And this is the page, in fact, it's page 13. And this book, I'm holding it in my hands, it is 8.5 by 14. And I don't know what type size that is, but I'm going to guess it's about 12, maybe 14. But I do know that for me, at 77, it's small type. But what I see on this one huge page are the annualized rates of return of dozens of different equity and fixed income asset classes, showing their returns for the 1 year ending December 31, 2020, the 5 years, the 10 years, the 15, the 20, the 50, and the 80 years results, compound rates of return for all of these different asset classes. And I can't say that every line is a lesson, but I can tell you that there are some very important lessons just on this one page of the book. For example, let me give you the first lesson, and I think I've got at least 12 lessons here for you that I hope you will give a serious consideration as you build your understanding of how investing works. The first two asset classes on the page are what is called the CRSP 1-10 index. Think of that as the total market index. It is all about 3,400 stocks. They are everything from very large, the first decile, all the way down to the very smallest, the 10th decile. And so when you think you're going to get a portfolio of stocks that has thousands, including small companies, including some small cap value, you would think that diversification was going to have some impact on the return that you get. You would think because it has small, it has value versus the S&P 500 is mostly growth and very large companies, 500 instead of 3,800. But what do we know about how that index is created? Well, it's based on what they call a cap-weighted index and a cap-weighted value, so that the very largest companies are going to have the greatest impact on the day-to-day movement of the index. And in fact, I just took a quick glance and estimated that in the S&P 500, about 50 companies represent almost 50%, over 40%, but almost 50% of all of the value of the holdings in this index. So big companies, very large companies, are going to drive the return. The small companies that we see in the CRSP, in the total market index, they're there. The value's there. It's not as what appears to be, you wouldn't think, as overweighted to large and growth. And I think it's closer to about 35% in those top 50 companies. But when you look at the return over a very long period of time, 80 years, it's virtually the same, 11.5% compound rate of return. Now, notice I said 80 years, not the 93 years that we talk about that we have from 1928 to 2020, and we show those in some of our tables. But here is what we know. Why are we making so much money in the S&P 500? How are we getting 11.5% when we always hear about 10? Because I've said many times, every extra half a percent is meaningful. Well, the reason the return is so high is because this starts in 1941, not 1928. You don't have to go through the Depression when you start in 1941. Yeah, you go through a war, you go several wars, you go through a lot of inflation along the way, and in fact, a lot of that inflation was what likely caused the extra returns in that 80-year period. When you look at 50 years, the S&P 500 compounds at 10.9, the total market 11. When we look at 20 years, the S&P 500 is 7.5, the total market 8.1. Going back 15 years, it's 9.9 for the S&P 500 versus 10.3. And the last 10 years, 13.9 for the S&P 500 and 14 for the total market index. And the point I just want to make here, because you know how favorably I rate the small cap value, how favorably I rate large cap value, as a matter of fact. But what do we see here? That when we have a cap-weighted portfolio, whether it's 500 companies or almost 3,800 companies, those large companies still dominate that long-term return. So that would be lesson number one, just to realize that whether you take the S&P 500 or the total market index, you are getting large cap blend as an asset class, basically, even though the total market index has maybe 5 or 6 or 7% small cap. It is not enough small cap to move the needle, which then takes me on to small cap. Let me talk about small cap here for a minute. Lesson number two is about small cap. And let's take a minute here and talk about how different those two asset classes are. Because small cap companies, the average size, let's say, runs about 2 or 1.5 to $5 billion. And there's a huge difference, and we'll talk about this, between the 1.5 and the 5, just as there is a big difference between the small cap companies and the $100 billion companies that you're likely to find, and by the way, much bigger than $100 billion, in the S&P 500 and the total market index. And within that small cap index, we're going to have some growth, we're going to have some value in the broad small cap index, and we can also segregate out just the small cap value, which I think you all now know has had the highest return of these major asset classes. And let's just look at the difference, that range of return, and let's look out over the 80 years. Remember, the S&P 500 and the total market index each compounded at 11.5. The small cap, now we're talking about starting, remember here now in 1941, not 1928. The small cap blend index compounded at 13.8%, and I'm using the DFA index numbers here, and the small cap value 16.2. So when you segregate out as an asset class, the small cap, not just make it a small part of a great big portfolio, but you get actual access to that asset allocation, that would have given you a much, much higher return. And in lesson number three, we get an opportunity to find out a couple of things here. One is 80 years versus 20. What would you trust? Which do you think has is the most meaningful information? Well, this is one of the challenges we have with the investment process. Our lives are relatively short. The market's life is relatively long. And we don't know what we're going to run into. We've talked in the past about how the decade from 1930 to 1939 experienced actually better returns than the decade from 2000 to 2009, at least in the S&P 500. And so should we think in terms of 80 years worth of information, 93 years? Does 20 make a difference? Well, 20 certainly made a difference as we look back at the last 20, because those big returns of 11.5 to 16.2 just aren't showing up over the last 20 years. And also in lesson number three, we see that when we invest in small cap or large cap, there can be a significant difference depending on what index you use. And let me just share a variety of asset classes as represented by the Russell indexes and the S&P or the DFA indexes, so that you can see that simply saying I have some small cap value in my portfolio is not exactly the same as saying I have the DFA small cap value or the Russell small cap value. Let me share some numbers. Remember, I'm sensitive about every 0.1%. And as I've said probably just over 500,000 times now, the past does not mean that the future will be the same. And we all know that. But let's just talk about this 20 years and how different it could be in terms of how an index is constructed. So now we have the Russell 1000 index, not 500, 1000, and we have the S&P 500, and over that 20-year period, the Russell compounded at 7.7, the S&P at 7.5, and the total market index, 8.1. So that was a significant difference, remembering that every 0.1% counts. If we look at the large cap value indexes, the Russell 1000 large cap value, 6.8%, and the DFA large cap value, 7.4%. Now there are a couple things that I'm thinking here. Now wait a minute. According to the past, a large cap value has outperformed the large cap blend by a significant amount. In fact, over the 80-year period, large cap value compounded about 13.4, a significant advantage over over the large cap blend, but not the last 20 years. So you find that, yes, DFA's large cap value construction was more profitable than the Russell 1000, but both underproduced the large cap blend returns. When we look at small cap blend, the Russell 2000 compounded at 8.7, this is over 20 years, versus the DFA small cap index compounded at 10.6. Huge advantage to DFA. Why was it a better result? Well, you have to look at the value aspect of it. You have to look at the size aspect of it. And there were advantages over that period of time. And now small did do better than large when it came to the size factor. And value did better than growth in terms of the blend aspect in the Russell 1000 and the S&P 500 and the total market, because the Russell 2000 small cap value 8.5, the DFA small cap value 11.1. So what's the takeaway in lesson number three here is that an asset class that has performed beautifully for a very long period of time can underperform for what seems like forever. Unfortunately, 20 years is not forever. It just feels like forever when you're not getting what you expected. And the other lesson under that one here is that how you construct these indexes does make a difference. How small is the small? How deeply discounted is the value? And lesson number four, looking again at that 20 years of performance, what are we to conclude about the premium that we should get from adding small to our portfolio or adding value to our portfolio? Well, first, let's just look for a second here at the 80-year performance. The large cap blend, and I'm using the DFA numbers here. That's where we have 80 years of performance. We don't have that with the Russell. But the large cap blend over 80 years compounded at 11.5, the small cap blend 13.8. And the large cap blend, again, 11.5 versus the small cap value of 16.2. So the small cap index was 2.3% better over the longer period and 4.7% better with the small cap value. On the other hand, when we look at the last 20 years, we see an advantage of small cap value over the S&P 500, the large blend, of anywhere from 1 to over 3% for the Russell and DFA small cap value. At the small cap blend, those advantages were not as great as we would expect, and about 1% with the Russell and a 2% approximately advantage for the small cap blend at the DFA index. So does this mean that we should expect slightly smaller premiums in the future? We don't know. As I sit here almost 6 months into 2021, I see that value has taken off like a rocket. I mean, is it going to fizzle? Is it going to continue? We don't know. But when you update these numbers for just the last 6 months, it does make a difference. And that's the nature of investing. One big year or a big decade can just have a huge impact on those long-term returns. which, of course, we are not allowed to be able to buy, that being the past. Lesson number 5. When I took the course at DFA in the, 1994, one of the things they made it very clear was this value benefit premium was not only available in the U.S. market, but historically it was available in almost every international market. And it is interesting to see when you look at the performance here in the matrix that if we look at large cap value and small cap value and large cap blend, we see that the returns were much lower than the returns of the U.S. markets, but the premiums for the small and the value were not totally unreasonable. In fact, the small cap blend compounded at 9.6 versus the large cap blend at 5.1, that's a premium that actually is a little higher than what we saw in the U.S. And small cap value of 10.5 versus the 5.1 for large cap blend. Again, certainly, well, in fact, again, better than the U.S. Premium for small cap value. What didn't do so well was large cap value. It produced about 0.5% additional return at 5.6. So what we found out was, as we're not shocked at, there are periods when international underperform the U.S., and there are periods when we don't get the premiums we expect. But in this particular case, the premiums were reasonable. Lesson number 6 has to do with the emerging markets. And that's a particularly difficult one to discuss because if we looked at the 20-year performance, we'd be probably pretty happy. For example, the emerging market large was 11.4% compound rate of return. The value index was 12%, and the small cap was 12.2. So that was far better than the other international asset classes. That's the good news. The bad news is, over the last 10 years, the small cap return was 4.2, value 1.5, and the large cap blend 4. So it's been a tough pill for people to swallow who saw those huge returns in the previous 10 years to only see the last 10 be so low. And what do you do with the fact that the emerging markets have helped the portfolios so much over the last 50 years versus having caused lower rates of return over the last decade? Unfortunately, that's the way a diversified portfolio works. Number 7, I need to at least mention bonds. They show quite a number of line items for bonds. But the bottom line is, over the last 20 years, the returns have been higher on the longer-term maturities base compared to the 80-year return. But the shorter-term instruments, the T-bills, the 30-day T-bills, have way underperformed the historic averages. For the last 20 years, the T-bills have compounded at 1.4% a year. The long-term treasuries, 7.4%. And by the way, that's not so different from what the S&P 500 did, producing a return of 7.5%. So that's just another example of where you can go for a very long period of time with equities and not get the premium that you would expect. Long-term corporates did better than the treasuries, up 8.1. But when we look back at the 80-year performance, we see that those short-term treasuries, instead of 1.4, have compounded at 3.7. And the long-term treasuries, instead of 7.4, have compounded at 5.9 over 80 years, and the long-term corporates at 6.2. So there's been a premium over the last 20 and 80 years for the corporates. It's only really the short-term instruments that have failed to give the kind of return people might have expected. And lesson number 8 is a short focus on inflation. That's one of the interesting decisions we make as an investor when we're planning for retirement many years from now, and that is, what assumption should we make for inflation? Inflation is a serious expense, if you want to look at it that way, in the growth of our investments. Over the 80-year period, that inflation rate was 3.7%. Now remember, that 80 years started in 1941, and we had a lot of inflation after World War II, and then of course we had late 70s into the 80s, another inflationary period. So if you go all the way back to 1928, it's about a 3% year number, but 3.7 since for the last 80 years. For the last 50 years, it's been 3.8. So actually a little more when you go back to 50. But the last 20, the inflation rate has been 2. Well, you can see what that means for people who held T-bills over that 20-year period. You would have lost money on an inflation-adjusted basis. In fact, when we look back all 93 years, it's about a break-even when you look at the inflation opposed to the return on T-bills. So they have basically just kept you even, which is one of the reasons it's very difficult to save enough money if you depend upon the growth of bonds to get you there. Now, certainly the longer-term bonds have paid a much higher return, a premium, for the extra volatility, because there's virtually no volatility in the 30-day T-bills as they're maturing and turning over, getting 100% of your investment back every 30 days. Lesson 9, in some ways, is the most interesting of the assets when we look back at the last 20 years. We do not have a commodity index that goes back 80 years, but we do have the Bloomberg Commodity Index, which does cover at least the 20-year period. Now, it's important to remember that when you go back 20 years, the idea that a great place to protect yourself from inflation was commodities, and a great place to have your money if you wanted to protect yourself against bear markets would be in commodities, because they're considered to be non-correlated to the stock market. So the idea is, maybe when the market goes down, commodities won't. What actually happened over the last 20 years, and I have to give credit to Dennis Tilley, who was the one that many years, more than the 20 years ago, made the point clearly, at least based on the numbers, that the expectation of commodities was basically T-bill rates, less expenses. And that's almost exactly what happened, because over the last 20 years, the Bloomberg Commodity Index lost money on an annual basis of about 0.5% a year. And remember, inflation was 2% a year, and the one-month T-bills a gain of 1.4% a year. So Dennis Tilley, at least for this 20-year period, One of the people in my life I consider to be not only really smart, but a straight shooter, truth teller, had called this one right. And the fact is that if you look at the periods of the market, investors rushing for the sidelines looking for someplace safe, it hasn't been commodities. It really has been the government bonds. And in fact, again, that was what Dennis Tilley recommended more than 20 years ago. If you really want to try to protect against the catastrophic, the government bonds tend to do well when we're under real heavy pressure. And you can go back and look at the returns of the long-term government bonds in the terrible markets and find that they were some of the best performers in virtually every case. And lesson 10 is all about, also about inflation. I think it's important to realize that equities are probably the best protection against inflation. The tough part about equities is that they are so volatile, and so you pick up this benefit long term, but you potentially create more short-term pain than you're willing to withstand, which is why we focus so much of our efforts on helping people determine how much they should have in fixed income along with the equities to, yes, be able to get the portfolio to grow at some reasonable rate ahead of inflation and have it be within whatever our risk tolerance might be. When we look at the last 80 years, the after inflation rate of return for the S&P 500 was 7.5%. So that was a very fine return. And over the last 20 years, a period that the stock market didn't do very well, but inflation was relatively low. And it turns out that after inflation, it was about a 5.3% rate of return. Still a good rate. When I came into the industry in 1966, what we were taught is if you're in retirement and you can get 2 or 3% better than inflation, that is considered a good return for a retiree. And again, I do want to note that the inflation-adjusted return over the 80 years for T-bills was basically zero. So that is not a good way to fight inflation. It is a way to, in essence, historically, stay even with inflation. But as I'll talk about in a second, there are some periods where Treasury bills underproduce the inflationary rate by a lot. Number 11, one of the beauties of the book is that I can look at any 40-year period going back to 1926, in some cases 28, in other cases, the numbers don't go back any more than 20 or 30 years. But the basics, the inflation, the bonds, the different major U.S. equity stock groups are all trackable. What is interesting is to see, and you may remember that I in the report that showed the long-term returns over 40 years on average of the S&P 500, we found the worst 40-year period was a gain of 8.9, and the best 40-year period was a gain of 12.5. Now, I would guess that most of us would like to have that 12.5 right out of the gate, have that be our experience. The problem is that sometimes you are fighting inflation in that process. So, for example, When I look at the 1950 through 1989 period, there's a 40-year period, the S&P 500 did compound at 12.5%. On the other hand, when you adjust it for inflation during that period, the return was 7.9%. On the other hand, if you looked at better returns in terms of after inflation, the best returns were 8.8 and 9.2 after inflation. But those didn't happen from 1950 to 1989. They happened from 1932 to 71 and 1933 to 72. So that is another way to look at their returns and to become realistic about what you should expect. Because we could have a period, as many of us worry about, inflation coming back into our financial lives. And theoretically, you got to get a better rate of return during those higher inflationary times. And number 12, I think maybe the most important lesson here is that we just have no way to predict what that series of returns are going to be. To say that it's luck whether we're going to be a successful investor or not is partly true, but it's not luck that you put the money aside and delay gratification for some lengthy period of time. That part is not luck. That takes planning. It is luck if you happen to be the son or daughter of very wealthy people. That doesn't have to do with your delayed gratification, but the reality is for most people, that's not the way they're going to accumulate the money they need to retire on. And I think it's important, too, when I look at these numbers, because I can look at every year from 1926 on with the S&P 500. I can see, for example, that going into 1929, the start of something really disastrous, that in 26, the market was up 11.6. In 27, it was up 37.5. In 28, it was up 43.6. You think people were worried about everything falling apart and going into the Great Depression? I don't think so. I'm sure somebody predicted it, but it certainly wasn't the common belief. And I think it would also be true to say that in 2000, after for 5 years, the S&P 500 compounds at 28.5%. Boy, you're just not thinking negatively at that point. You're not ready for a 50% loss, but it came. And then it was good for a few years, and then we had another 50% loss. So in two periods, two bear markets, in the period from 2000 to 2009, both times it took away about 50% of the value of your portfolio. But that's not so much a warning as it was a fact. And as we've said before, there's no risk in the past. We know exactly what we should have done. And what we must remember, if we're young investors, I'm not. But what I want young investors to think about is that those periods that followed 1929 and the 30s and that followed the huge run-up in the late 90s, those were amazing opportunities for young people to buy into a declining market that later paid them a huge reward. And the reality is that's where the most money is made, when in essence the risk is the highest, when people are really uncomfortable to put money in the market. So right now, everything's going along just fine. But for young investors, be prepared to think positively when the market starts to decline, and I mean getting hit hard. On the other hand, I'm just hoping that people will take us seriously, and those in retirement or close to it have enough fixed income to help them weather the storm of a really ugly bear market. They are normal. So what's the bottom line? I think the bottom line is this, that 20 years is not a long period of time as an investor. And that as part of the process of investing, whether you're 21 or you're 91, is the possibility for the next 10 or 20 years that things are going to be unproductive, uncomfortably unproductive, possibly. And that is the reason that at the end of our lives, we are supposed to be able to have recovered a premium for the risk that we take for periods of low production. And that a diversified portfolio of many asset classes is likely to give you a better opportunity to stay the course as they weave and bob and weave at different times. And look recently how unproductive emerging markets have been, how unproductive compared to history small cap and value has been, at least up until since the first of the year. So those are the lessons that we're supposed to be hearing. Is massive diversification in asset classes that have a long history of decent returns. Knowing that some portion of that portfolio will not live up to our expectations. I hope some of this helps. I wish that this matrix was produced for everybody. I think it would be wonderful if DFA should decide to produce it for all readers, but I will continue to bring what I think are the highlights of that book and others that are built to make you a better investor. Thank you for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.